The Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt. Representative Hewitt. Representative Cleavorne.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero. Representative Lucero. Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston. Representative Poston. Representative Rowley.
Rowley present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Poston. That concludes roll call.
Very well, members, we do have a quorum. And our first item of business will be to adopt our minutes from our last meeting. And I'm going to need some help on the date of that meeting from the clerk. What's the date of our last meeting?
The 15th.
15th. Representative Zhang, I'm wondering if you would do us the favor of moving the minutes of January 15th.
Mr. Chair, so move.
Thank you. Representative Zhang moves. Adoption of the minutes from January 15th. Discussion. Very well. We'll do this by voice vote. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And the minutes of January 15th of this committee are adopted. Members.
Chair Mariani.
Representative Johnson.
I just noticed that Representative Poston does have his hand up, so I believe he's here, but he may be having audio difficulties.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I greatly appreciate that. The clerk will note the attendance and presence of Representative Poston, and perhaps our someone from our staff can assist him to make sure that he's connected with us.
Chair Mariani, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can, Representative Poston. Okay.
I think it was operator error, sir, so I've got it fixed.
Boy, I've never done that. well, welcome. It's good to hear your voice, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you.
Members, today we're going to we will not have bills today to act on. We are shortly getting close to that part of our committee work. We are continuing in our review of both executive branch department and board's work that fall under the jurisdiction of this committee, as well as to cover vital, present and vital issues that our state faces in the vein of public safety. And today's hearing really falls in, more in that second category. Members, let me just share very, very quickly that for this chair, and I know it's true for a number of my colleagues, I suspect and I hope on both sides of the aisle, that public safety in a democracy is a balancing of human rights and personal safety. Human rights, which are constitutionally a duty of supremacy, of supreme importance for us as elected officials to meet. And personal safety is a core function of any government and also vital for us as elected officials to meet. It's my posture that these two need not be in conflict. As I scan across the globe, I can point to states where they, in fact, are in conflict. But they need not be in conflict in our society. And, in fact, I believe that they are mutually reinforcing. And so, therefore, laws and policies should reflect advancing, promoting, protecting, and doing both, always focused on the care for human life. And so, members, today within that chair's understanding and beliefs of the important nexus of human rights and public safety, we're going to hear two presentations, first from the Department of Corrections on the recent challenge of the COVID-19 pandemic in terms of the department meeting its duties to human rights and to the personal safety of all residents in our facilities, those who are serving time as well as those who are entrusted with their care, and by extension, the public to which they are connected to. And so we're going to hear a presentation on the department's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. We will have about 20 minutes of that presentation, followed by a 20-minute discussion among committee members. Then we'll move to a related issue as a second part of our agenda. We will hear, actually, members, for some of you or for those of you who were here last year on this committee, it'll be in many ways a rehearing from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on safety in state correctional facilities, a report that they presented to us in 2020. And so we will hear a presentation for about 20 minutes from the OLA, and then followed by a discussion for 20 minutes after that. It is my understanding that there may be, that there is public comment being requested. And so we will reserve the latter, the end of both of those presentations to take that comment. And we will hopefully move expeditiously through the agenda to make sure that those individuals who wish to comment would have the opportunity to do that. And so with that, members, I'm going to call forward Commissioner Paul Schnell, the Department of Corrections, to begin the conversation on the DOC's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Commissioner Schnell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's an honor to be back here again. I'm going to do a share screen here, and hopefully we get the right one. Are you able to see the PowerPoint there, hopefully?
That looks good, Commissioner.
All right, excellent. I'm going to start out first by just talking a little bit about our mission and our vision. And I put this up here despite the fact that we're talking today about our COVID response, because this has got to be up really core and central to everything that we do. And certainly this has been one of the things that we've thought of throughout the time of our COVID response, despite the range of challenges that COVID has presented, both in our correctional facilities, for our agency, and really for everyone in our state. Some of this is going to be things that we talked about, but I want to just point out a little bit with regard to this. You know, this one side just gives you a little bit of some perspective of our agency, as we talked about last week, but I wanted to focus on the other side. At the beginning of COVID, prior to COVID, we had a population of about 9,200 people. That was when the OLA was doing their work here. It was approximately 9,200. In March 20th of 2020, really the start of the pandemic in our state, the first case we had in our state, I believe March 6th, we were at 8,857 in terms of our internal population. It went down to 79.58, a drop of about 800 to 900 in July 1 of 2020. And then now we're in that roughly between 72.50 and 73.50, with January 1st being at 73.25. And as I pointed out last time we met, you know, just in terms of in general times, we end up releasing about 600 people per month, just on a regular everyday basis of people who are working their way through the system. About between 500 and 600 a month, our people are released from our system. Again, just to give you a perspective on where our facilities are located and their populations. You know, I point this out again only because I want to give some emphasis to that top one, and that really we do have this obligation to provide health care to those incarcerated, including treatment services and rehabilitation programs. And I think the other side of this is that our supervision services has to be connected with the services that we provide inside. Moving to talk a little bit about COVID response more specifically. I'm going to talk through kind of these are the elements that we saw as core during the course of our strategy. Now, you know, planning and population management, really working on hygiene and the access to personal protective equipment, quarantine and isolation, and access to medical care. Health screening and comprehensive testing was really a part of our strategy. The modification of our programs and communication along with visitation and information and management and sharing. And we'll talk about these, but these really, this kind of gives you a sense of these were the core kind of elements of what went into our overall response and COVID management strategy in the DOC. When we think about population management, you know, as was pointed out, we gave a lot of focus to making sure that we had a good sense of what was happening. We know that our numbers went down dramatically because the courts went offline. We did, in the early days, we really focused on what were the options we had to ultimately reduce some of our population to maximize social distancing. This was a major concern. We looked at a couple of different options. One of those options was looking at work release as one of our management strategies. As you know, Minnesota Department of Corrections has had for many, many decades used work release as a population, as a reentry tool, as a tool that where people could serve the last chunk of their time is typically how it's been applied. Although the statute gives a lot more latitude, work release can be used with certain segments of our population. Generally, some of those people who've committed nonviolent offenses, they can be released as early as 50% of their sentence. They can engage in a whole range of activities while they're in the community, including work, treatment, education, a wide array of programs. Typically, currently work release is used in the 6 to 8 month range for most people. They generally will be released through a halfway house or through a county jail across our state with some case management services and supervision to help guide that. During COVID, we looked at assessing people who were within 90 days of their release date, who are in the low to moderate risk categories from a MnSTAR, which is our risk assessment tool, and had a viable options for being able to be monitored at a residence throughout the scope of the pandemic. We had you know, approximately around 160 thereabouts of people who went out through that program. hygiene and personal protective equipment. We'll give you some slides with some details around some of these things. But this was a very big issue across our state. It continues to be something we monitor closely. The DOC was a bit fortunate because we have a pandemic plan that is in place, as most state agencies do. We also had a stockpile of some supplies, personal protective equipment supplies. But you can see, for instance, the hand washing station there, we really implemented and went out and were able to either procure or rent hand washing stations that we could quickly deploy into the facilities for staff as they came and went from the facilities. And then we also used our MinCor Industries, the folks in our facilities, and I'm really proud of them and MinCor and the work that they did, sewing up literally thousands and thousands of masks. Each person in our facility, each of our staff people were issued a barrier mask that were made by people in the facilities, and even the people in the facilities who were in those garment shops and doing that sewing, I think we're really felt proud of the fact that they were able to make that equipment, to make those barrier masks and get them out across the system. They were also issued to some other state agencies, as well as halfway houses and other partners that we have across the system. They also got into making barriers for things like visiting, for visits, for other types of meetings. And you can see on the right hand side there, the plastic barrier. There was just a tremendous amount of work done. We really worked to try and engage people through this process. We wanted there to be good distancing to the extent that we were able to do that. And that impacted some of our programming, as I'll talk about in a little bit. Quarantine and isolation, along with the medical care, this becomes so essential. While we had some of these plans, it does become challenging when you're in these pandemic environments. The bottom line is, in a static environment where people don't move or you don't have to move people in and out, it would be very simple to manage your population. The bottom line is we have to move our people through the system. As you know, men, as I mentioned last week, come in through St. Cloud, women come in through Shakopee, and ultimately then get dispersed. And eventually, St. Cloud in particular, we have a lot more men coming in, will become full, and we have to be able to move people out. We also want to make sure that to the extent that we can, we maintain social distancing, we keep people in a quarantine status when they come in from county jails. And some of these things have been not without challenges, not without different issues. We certainly learned a lot in the early stages of this. We had one of the early outbreaks at Moose Lake. While we really tried to keep people in their units to a large degree, we had people attending programming. And one of the examples that I think was a big learning experience, and perhaps we should have caught it sooner, but nonetheless, this is what happens. We had people that attended education programs, and while they lived in separate units, they were connecting at an education program, and we believe it was during an education program where a staff person may have had COVID, again, unknown to them initially. They became sick ultimately, and we saw our first outbreak in that when the people who were exposed to it then went back to their housing units, we saw some spread in those units. And so it really helped us to think more about quarantine, having places to be able to put people for that 14-day period of time, isolation for those people who either were symptomatic or tested positive, and then making sure we were monitoring people as we had experienced outbreaks. And as you know, we had some significant outbreaks that really happened at the start of the heating season here, Stillwater being the first example of that, where we went for 5.5 months without a single positive case at that facility. I think a real testament to the staff and, frankly, the men who are incarcerated there and in terms of that working that partnership. maintaining that facility without a single positive case, only in late October and early November to have it go from zero cases for 5 months to 900 cases in a matter of 4 weeks. So it just spoke to the fact that these are challenging environments to manage and maintain. The picture that you see there is, I believe, a Stillwater cell front. That is a typical door front face to a cell at Stillwater, and probably would be typical of what you might see at St. Cloud as well. And then you can look at some of our other facilities where we have solid core doors with windows and pass-through slots. Ultimately, much easier to contain the spread of a virus like this that's airborne in an environment where you can close off or contain the fronts of the cells. And so I think this was one of the challenges that we've experienced throughout the pandemic. Health screening and testing. Early on, we, like many state agencies, began a comprehensive testing of staff when they came in, as it was all part of built into the hand washing stations. We're checking temperatures and checking for symptoms on a regular basis. This was really in the early days prior to testing becoming more readily available. As soon as we were able to, we implemented a comprehensive testing strategies. And Minnesota deserves to feel proud. We have one of the highest testing rates in the country, and probably on a per capita basis, the highest. We were fourth highest, right behind California, Texas, and Florida. Several other Midwest states were very close. But ultimately, given the size of our population, we probably on a per capita basis tested the most. Testing was really, we think, helpful for our staff. We did mandatory sentinel testing of both our staff as well as people in the population. It allowed us to, I think, better control spread as much as that was possible throughout the pandemic, because we were able to see where outbreaks were, move people to isolation, and then ultimately try to contain the spread. Again, we found that in the early days of the pandemic, that was a bit easier. Once the heating system started, we did find it a bit more challenging to maintain that. This is an example of program modification. You can see that they're using an area where we can set up tables and move people wide apart and provide different types of programming, education, and so forth. We've had to do this. We've also had done other types of modification, like education information being delivered to people in the units and picked up, graded with feedback coming back to them. We've worked to try and expand the use of our tablet technology. Fortunately, we are seeing a rollout of a new tablet technology that will be provided to every single person who is in our custody, as opposed to right now, those tablets have to be purchased. The new tablet technology will be launched here, we think, in February. We should see that start to go, and that will provide us with a whole host of other options to program with people right from inside their cells if need be. Early on, we also modified and canceled visitation across the system. We did this early as a containment strategy. We know that visiting is really critical to people who are incarcerated, and certainly their loved ones. And so we take that very seriously. We are one of the only states that has since opened it up, although the threshold for visiting, in the Midwest, there's only, I believe, one other state that is doing any visiting. And in our state, it means that if a facility has two or less, two or more cases, visiting is canceled. So, and that's either from staff or members of the population. So it's very tight. We do have some facilities that are visiting right now, which is great news and really, really important across the board. Communication-wise, we really have worked to try and do communication. We've stepped up the number in each facility. There are kind of resident councils that meet with staff, and those folks really have done more meetings. We've also done some video messaging. We did town hall calls with family members of people who were incarcerated to talk about our strategies to try and address people's concerns along the way. You can also see on the picture on the right, we really work to utilize technology. These are court hearings and parole hearings and pardon board hearings and really across our state using technology that has been infrastructure that is there. And we think that this was really a great use. It really reduced the amount of travel time for sheriffs across our state and allowed courts to proceed with some of these hearings, but doing it in a way that was remote and really worked well. We think we'll have some merit as we go forward in terms of improving efficiency and safety. I would also say that if you haven't seen it, we have a really, really robust COVID dashboard that's public facing. It's on our website. It gets updated 5 days a week. It's about the information is about 24 to 30 hours behind, but nonetheless, we report on the previous day's activity every day. And this was from about a week and a half or so ago. The number of deaths we've had now at 11 deaths, but it covers really a comprehensive amount of data, including early release programs, the number of people who tested positive, what the status of each facility where there is outbreaks, the number of people recovered versus the number of people who are positive, staff positivity rates, and again, any of the COVID-related release programs that we implemented, work release, conditional medical release, and then we did do some reduction of revocation during the course of COVID. We'll talk a little bit about this. COVID work release, I've talked a little bit about before. 320 have been granted release across the system and using a variety of these strategies. COVID conditional medical release is a conditional medical release is a statutory authority that is granted to the agency. It's most typically used in end of life situations where people who are nearing end of life, their condition is grave, that they can be released into the community. It's conditional in the sense that should something change, they would be brought back into the facility. About 150 people have been released on a conditional medical release, and some of these people, will ultimately, depending upon vaccination and where our state sits, they could be required to be come back into DOC custody because of the conditional nature of that release. That was a very comprehensive review. It is a process. We did a public safety component. There is also a physician. Our medical director reviewed every case. We had 2,800 people apply, and about 100 and just shy of 160 were granted. Release violator management. We really tried to reduce the number of release violators coming back into the system. Worked with our partners in probation and supervised release supervision across the state to try and manage that. And we did see those numbers drop off dramatically as well. And really at any given time in our state, about 11% of the people in our custody are release violators, about 14% are probation violators who are committed, ultimately then committed to the department by the courts. We did have coronavirus relief requests throughout the course of this, and talk a little bit about what that covered, but it really covered everything from our staffing needs. We had large outbreaks of positivity among our staff as well, requiring us to use a lot of overtime. We often had to have you know, nursing staff come in on an overtime basis to manage some of these outbreaks. Lots of supplies. Our food costs went up during the course of this because we were delivering food to the units, which means everybody gets it, and instead of people choosing what they wanted or didn't want. And so food costs went up as well throughout the course of this. PPE costs and some of our testing costs are reflected here. Ultimately, we reported on this. We covered some COVID leave. When those people, some of our folks were released on conditional medical release, we provided some funding to counties to be able to assist us with that supervision of those folks. Air quality studies and equipment were purchased during the course of this because, again, we were really trying to get a handle on how we went for so long with low numbers of positivity, and then all of a sudden we saw these big, huge spikes at places like Faribault, St. Cloud, and Stillwater, most notably. This just gives you a sense of our PPE supplies at the start. You can see back in March where we were in terms of the full range of masks. We had that 69,095 really is a reflection of some of that pandemic planning reserve that we have and maintain in the agency, which we were really grateful for. We did, in the early days, as we were able to, release some of that back to the SEOC so that they could distribute some of those across the state where healthcare needs were greatest. At the time, we were able to manage with barrier masks. We have maintained, and you know, we go through a lot of masks right now. Surgical masks, you know, we can go through many every single day. On the mask changes every 4 days for N95s, so that can change. That moves pretty quickly, and sometimes we have to change those more often. Things like heat in the early days affected those masks a bit more. Surgical masks require daily changing. We are as outbreaks develop, we're sending those out to both population and staff. And then sometimes they just have to be replaced on a more regular basis. And I already talked about the fact that Marine Corps did make both barrier masks. They made gowns that were able to be used. They also made many of the face shields that you're seeing here. Were made by Marine Corps folks and distributed across the system. We do have a requirement that people in our facilities, so both the folks who live there as well as the staff, wear their masks inside the facilities. We have, and I'm sure many of you have heard that there were challenges around this. We have done some compliance checking, and we have found that compliance across the system has been largely quite good over the course of time. And I think we saw in the early days when we had heat over the summer, it became really tough, especially in some of, you know, many of our facilities. There is no, the ability to manage airflow, and they are not air conditioned and so forth. It really gets very hot in there for staff as well as the people who are in there. We tested in accordance with directions from MDH, and we've been really grateful for them. They were in this from start to finish with us have been amazingly helpful throughout the course of it. We meet with them multiple times each week. Some people have asked how is testing done? We do supervised tests. We have a strike force that goes out and does these testing. They will hand them the swab, and the swab will be taken by the person. The swab is completed, labeled, and then sent to the lab. Medical information is really handled for people in our population. It's in their part of their medical record, and for our staff, it strictly goes to human resources. We have had some test refusals, those really result in being treated as though they are positive, and they go into an isolation status for that 14 days. And as I mentioned, both staff and population testing is mandatory. To date, as of 1/4, we spent just over $1 million, And when all of those services are billed through the end of the year, we believe that testing costs will be approximately $3.5 million in whole, all of that charged to CRF funding. That is staff testing, and we've done very aggressive staff testing. Our tests of our population are managed and handled and paid for by the SEOC as part of the state's overall strategy. During COVID, we used modified lockdown to manage, especially during outbreak times. We looked at how we could encourage connections, and one of the ways was we were able to negotiate with our phone system provider and get 2 free 5-minute phone calls each week for people. Since the start of the pandemic, over 500,000 calls have taken place. We increased behavioral health check-ins when outbreaks occurred and really reminded staff to check on people and make sure that they were reporting that. And we modified, as I mentioned, education and treatment services. Vaccine rollout, we are following the community standard, and I think this is really important. Our healthcare staff, we've started that, and the majority of them will have that vaccine soon. They're rolling it out on a shift basis as often as they can. We have also done a small number of people in our facilities. These are the people who would have been in long-term care or nursing home level care across the DOC. And that is, again, in accordance with the community standard. And I would just say that as we look at vaccinations and how vaccinations get handled with our population, some would say, look, this is they're prisoners. They're people who have done wrong. We view this not as a corrections or a criminal justice issue, but a public health issue. And that's why we take our lead from the CDC and the Minnesota Department of Health. Our staff will be prioritized as first responders. Supply chain is obviously one of the biggest concerns that we have. And we are really working on educating our population and, frankly, our staff, and just in terms of how important vaccination is. We do know that courts are backlogged. As I said, we do not believe that there will be a massive crush in cases, creating a population crisis as we get into this. We think that will probably be managed, although there we will have some increased numbers of people coming into the system, no doubt. As we address the population increase, we will continue our prevention and management strategies, and hopefully the vaccine rollout will really coincide with a lot of that. And as we look to the future, what we've learned, I think some of the things that we have to talk about is looking at our facilities. These are things that will come up in OLA, our double bunking strategy across our state, and especially in those facilities that were not built for this way, the use of ongoing or stepped up hygiene practices, and the prioritization of deferred maintenance, especially those related to air handling systems, and really our facilities across the board. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I would stand for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate the presentation. I am struck by a number of things that you shared. I won't go through all of them because we do have some members with questions here. But let me just say two things. One is I do want to acknowledge, we talk about systems, but in the end, we're talking about people. And I do want to acknowledge the incredible stress and high expectations that the pandemic has posed for your staff, both your guards as well as your health and education support staff. I just can't imagine the pressures that they face as they continue to meet the duties that we expect of them in our state. So shout out of appreciation to all of your people, especially your line folks. I also do want to say very quickly that, and I won't expound on it, but that, you know, and we had this conversation at the end of the regular session and through part of the special sessions last year in terms of, you know, how can a legislature continue to bolster the ability, and this isn't just unique to DLC, but to the commissioner, the commissioner's ability to use rulemaking authority in order to do the right thing. And the right thing in this case means, first and foremost, the public health and safety of the entire public, quite frankly, but very specifically those who we have a duty under our state laws, as well as morally to look out for their health and care, precisely because they are in our custody. And, you know, this will be a conversation we'll continue throughout, you know, the session, but it does seem to me that in instances where the legislature, so I'm pointing a finger at me, is not addressing the ability of our commissioners and our commissioners, because they're the ones responsible for rulemaking in their departments, to be able to do what they need to do, to have the authority to do what they need to do, then it's reasonable, not only that, but I think it's statutorily incumbent that the executive branch act and move with assertive authority precisely because of the core duties that we have for life and safety. And vice versa, you know, when the executive branch is not acting, it's incumbent on us as a legislature to be pushing our statutory frameworks to make sure that we're meeting those needs. So anyway, I just want to lay that out, not a formal question, but just an ongoing conversation I intend to have with you, and that I hope our committee will have as well. With that, members, we have a couple, several questions. I'll start with Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Commissioner. I just want to acknowledge what a tough job this must be during a pandemic. And public health and public safety being top of mind in these facilities is a really challenging task to be tasked with. But prisons are congregate care settings. And so in terms of you know, getting vaccines, I think that is really important. You know, I remember it was the last year that we're having shortages, I thought, in terms of officers, staffing. So I can't even imagine what that looked like. I would love to hear a little bit more about that, because I do understand that the last few years, that's been a challenge, which is the same thing that we're seeing in our schools, is the staffing challenges. But in a prison, you can't necessarily just close a prison down. So what has that looked like? How have you filled those gaps? And then I'm happy to hear that visits are resuming in some prisons. When do you see them resuming throughout all of the prisons? I think, you know, people, I am curious too, just, I apologize, there's a lot of thoughts from what everything you just put, but I'm wondering in terms of violence, with the lack of education, programming, and lack of visits, did you see an increase in violence at all? So if you could touch on that as well, and I think that's all of my thoughts. Thank you.
Good questions, but I'll look for concise answers. Commissioner.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, I think, you know, to your point, I think I'm really proud of our staff. They did a phenomenal job. They showed up in spite of the fact that some of these facilities had just massive outbreaks. Frankly, you know, we saw throughout the pandemic, because of the job market and the pressures on the job market, we saw a dramatic increase in the number of people applying to work in the DOC, which is good news. Bringing them on during the course of this and that process was a little bit challenging. We have worked through a lot of that, but ultimately one of the things that COVID relief or coronavirus relief money was used for was a lot of overtime expenses, because we had to manage through overtime. We do think that visiting will, you know, as this, we get distribution of a vaccine more globally available. We don't know exactly what that looks like yet. Many of the states in our Midwest area have not determined exactly what that's going to look like, nor do we know exactly when, you know, when we would be sequenced. And really, we're hoping to see changes in supply chain, which ultimately would answer some of those questions as soon as possible. But we do believe that there's some benefit in doing our staff and our population at the same time because they are in a sympathetic environment. And then, you know, finally, the question of around violence, we did not see. And I think this is a testament to both our staff as well as the people in our population. The people showed a lot of folks in our population showed tremendous grace. There's no rule book for this. And they worked with us. And I think family members, we really tried to be responsive. We had these town hall meetings. We stepped up our communications inside. And we just did not see increases in violence across the system, which we're really grateful for.
Indeed. Representative Huat. Huat. I believe you're muted, Representative.
Yep, I'm still learning that button. Anyways, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the commissioner, two real brief questions. One is, and I may have missed it, and I'm sorry if I did, but the cost affiliated with COVID itself, I'm sure you have a running tally on this because it's not over yet. Do you have a approximate what you have had to put into just this the pandemic at this point for our prison population?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we know that, you know, we were shy of $10 million coronavirus relief fund, but to look at the full range of this in terms of what the number of staff that we may have had out or that those sorts of things, the costs associated with just that alone is going to be dramatic. And so I don't have that information. I think it is a really great question, and then we'll do some work because we've been trying to code even things like some of our costs of people being out and those sorts of things. Just even the cost that we've had of moving a lot of our staff in central office and even in some of the facilities to the extent that we could to remote working and some of those sorts of things, there has been a lot of costs that really have been just borne by the agency. But I think things that when we look at the total cost of this, it's going to be dramatic, and I will work on getting that number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick follow-up then on that. A statement then, Commissioner, I just want to see if you started, I don't mean to say dreaming, but I don't think this is the last superbug we're going to have to deal with in our lifetime or maybe even in my legislative time. And I'm wondering what planning is going into effect that as we make investments in our prisons, I'm on bonding and how we do that, are we taking into consideration that we may have to go to a full isolation or how we're going to protect both staff and inmates in the future? Have we started having that thought process?
Well, a great question, Representative Hewitt. I share your concern about the evolving nature of these kind of infectious diseases across the planet. It seems like almost weekly we hear about something new and novel that's developing different parts of the planet. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hewitt, I think it's a great question. I will tell you that early on we set up an incident management team. That incident management team has tracked every single directive, and we use an incident management team so that we have more of a systemic approach. We're not seeing, you know, 10 different correctional facilities using 10 different processes. And, you know, one of the things I think that we've learned so much about our facilities, I think it's going to tie in a little bit to the conversation that's going to follow this with OLA and the aging of some of our facilities. How do we ultimately manage this? How do we create space for the management of this? And yet, how do we really smartly manage our population and maintain public safety? Because I think there really are ways that we can do both and ultimately make smart and strategic investments in our facilities to manage the next superbug that hopefully will be a long way away, but nonetheless be able to get our way through that, and at the same time really look at implementing strategies. You know, one of the things that just a great example of that was, as we looked at hand washing stations, we started to have conversations about if hand washing is good during a pandemic, maybe hand washing should be something that we really systematize and build in every day. And so as we think about that, how do we start to really implement those kinds of strategies every day in every way so they become a part of our natural business, which is just good hygiene and good health? So we are looking at that, and we will ultimately develop a comprehensive set of strategies once we get through the management of this that we think we would love to be able to come back to you and talk about, and then looking at that in line with our budget stuff, and especially our investments, capital investments going forward, and our maintenance costs of our facility. So absolutely, we will come back to, and have a comprehensive recommendation.
Very well. Members, we have about 9 minutes to get three more questions in, so I'm going to work to get that. I'm going to ask everyone to help me with that because I want to make sure we have adequate time to hear from our legislative auditor. So I have Representative Frazier, then Representative O'Neill, and Representative Johnson. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner Schnell, thank you for your presentation. That's very, very informative, very helpful. Since we have short time, I'll be quick. You mentioned the 320 individuals that are out on the that you released out. Are all those individuals on supervised release? Is the first question.
Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knoll, many of these people would be on a work release status, which means that they're supervised by DOC personnel during the course of that. Those people that are on conditional medical release, they went out on a modified supervised release status. So they are in the community and essentially are on house arrest status and at their home.
Representative Frazier, follow up.
Just to follow up, and have we had any, are there any trends of any violations of those releases?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, we have had a few violations. It's always going to happen. Unfortunately, it's something that you want to do everything we can to avoid. But I would say that that number has been minuscule. The exact number, I don't even, know. I think it's less than a couple of dozen. We have done some restructuring, and some of this was communication things that we had to work through. Some of it is, that we release people to home, and there may have been challenges around just even the families being able to afford taking care of that person, transportation to doctor's appointments. So there's a range of things that have come up, but we've worked through as many of those. We have had a few people fail.
Very well, thank you. Commissioner Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the sake of time, I'll just ask one question instead of the three I was going to.
Thank you.
Specifically, I was looking at the OLA report, and in 2019, there were 236,000 overtime hours, which equates to 115 full-time employees. That was just back in 2019, before the pandemic. And I know you talked about overtime. I'm wondering if you could tell us if you have the number of FTE equivalents or how many hours of overtime you've had to do because of the pandemic, and if you've actually been able to hire some staff to alleviate some of the stress on the corrections officers who have been just so inundated. I know we only had about 2,100 corrections officers, including their supervisors, back in January of 2020. And of course, the pandemic hit really bad in March. So just wondering if you could help me understand, do we move the needle at all? Or what do we, where do we stand now with the staff that we need, corrections officers specifically, to give them some relief?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we are hiring, and as I said, we are bringing people in through a different process, getting them into those facilities. We've you know, we still have some places where we have had challenges. And then, you know, we went through the challenge around the talk of the budget issues related to closure. So we kept some positions open so folks could land in spots. Then when that funding came through for Togo and Willow River, we didn't have to address moving our staff. Our numbers are, so we see our hiring numbers on the way up. There's a couple of areas in the state where we still face some challenges, where it's been harder to recruit people in, Faribault being one of them. But ultimately, we think that we're turning that corner. The challenge we've had is that, in addition to the staffing, some of the staffing issues that we've had, which we think we're turning the corner around, we can't get a good glimpse because so much of it's COVID related. We have people having community exposure, or a family member gets exposed to COVID, becomes positive, and now they aren't coming into work. So it has just been immensely challenging and immensely costly. I can get the total number of overtime dollars related to COVID and what that would convert to in FTEs. I don't have that number right now, but I'll get that for you.
Thank you. I think that would be helpful, particularly as we move forward with our budgetary decisions. The final question, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Commissioner Snell, I want to thank you for the work you've been doing. It's been a very difficult situation. I just had some concerns about the beginning of the pandemic. I believe things have changed now. We had concerns that for a while, even after everybody else was locked down back in March and April and May and June, they were still moving prisoners around from prison to prison. While we couldn't get haircuts, the prisoners still had their hair, barbershops were open. While we couldn't go, well, I know you have to feed the inmates, instead of changing the program where everybody going at one time, they're still sitting shoulder to shoulder during their meal times. And so that was sort of frustrating for us. I'm glad the one facility you're talking about had, up until this fall, had no cases, which is great. But we also had issues where it looked like at the beginning that you weren't doing enough to try to relieve issues, and I know talking to my counterpart in the Senate, they were getting very frustrated with things going on. I've been the number of guards have talked to me about some of the things the inmates to get away with, which have finally now been corrected. But it was just rough on the corrections officers and very rough on their families, which some of the things were going on where they're just rushing. I'm glad you're seeing some things that I'm thrilled about is the tablet issue where you're getting the tablets. One question I have, some inmates are purchasing the tablets already, but now you're looking at a program to give it to them. I'm wondering if you're going to have to reimburse those who purchased them, and if you figured out how to do that yet. And the other issue is again, I'm glad you're giving them the free phone calls, 5 minutes twice a week. But that adds up to a lot of dollars, since it's if I recall, that is a vendor that provides that information. Is the state paying the vendor for all those phone calls, and how are we going to continue paying for that with a certain, since especially when we have a deficit coming up?
Commissioner, two questions there.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, first of all, we negotiated those phone calls at no cost to the state. So those, we went to the back out to the vendor and asked the vendor to do this. And they did this in a number of states across the country that they were working with. On the tablet front, no, we will not be reimbursing. This would be like a change in technology. The tablet you had at one point in time is no longer kind of able to do what you needed to do, and you have to get a new one. Similarly, what's going to happen here is that this didn't come at significant that cost to the state. It's really part of the RFP process that this vendor that got this contract will be distributing these to all of the population. and the old tablets that people do own, they will be able to continue to access the content that they may have purchased, music or a book or something like that, that they were able to access. So that stuff will still be accessible to them, but the tablet will not have the functionality on the internal closed network. So that's that response. I would just say that early on, certainly I will be the first to tell you that we made mistakes, that we learned a lot. But ultimately, I would just say, as it relates to management of correctional facilities, that we're trying to balance both the public health and public safety things that need to happen. And ultimately, one of the things we saw across the country was high levels of unrest, riot activities, and resulting in serious injuries and in some cases deaths to staff as well as people in the population. And that was the last thing that we wanted to happen here. So were there things that we did to manage our population and to increase the likelihood of reducing violence in our facilities? Yes. And I would argue that is and continues to be the right thing to do, because ultimately we have to manage the full range of objectives.
Thank you, Commissioner. A little bit of uncharted waters for all of us, quite frankly. COVID isn't going away tomorrow. And so I suspect that this conversation will, more than suspect, I expect this conversation to be ongoing throughout the rest of this legislative session. I do want to just acknowledge there were some questions generally around vaccination and who gets vaccinated, who doesn't. We're out of time for this. I don't want to get into it right now, but I do want to acknowledge, because I always look for an opportunity wherever I can to be able to be on the same page with my counterpart over in the other body. You made this presentation last week. And the response from my counterpart relative to that issue is a recognition and an affirmation that those who are in our custody are also in our care for their health care needs, among other things. That's a statutory obligation that we have to them, and that approaching then the vaccination protocols is to keep that constantly in mind. And of course, as you shared earlier, to do that within the directions of our CDC and MDA. So I just do want to acknowledge that publicly, that my colleague on the other body and myself do agree with the way that you're planning to move forward with that. With that, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for your work, and look forward to continuing this conversation. Members, we're going to slide over. We probably are not going to have, well, I know we're not going to have the time to do the question period of the next, but I did want to make sure that our legislative auditor had the full amount of time that we had allotted for them to be able to do this presentation. And so if nothing else, I want to make sure they get that in. I don't want them to cut out vital information. So I'm just signaling to you, Mr. Kirchner, to go ahead and proceed with giving us the presentation you prepared for us today. So with that, the chair calls forward David Kirchner, Evaluation Coordinator at the Office of the Legislative Auditor, to talk about the report, the State Correctional Facilities report that was issued last year in regards to safety in our correctional facilities. Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your hearing this report from us again. Once again, for the record, my name is David Kirshner, and I am with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I was the manager for our look at safety in state correctional facilities. There is a full printed report, and if any of the members would like to receive a printed copy of the report as opposed to just getting a hold of it online, because I know that not all of the members were part of this committee last year, please contact our office and we would be happy to arrange to get you a printed copy of the report. We'd be happy to do that. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen now and start off with the presentation.
And while you're doing that, members, you could also reach out to our committee legislative assistant who can work with Mr. Kirchner to get you that if you don't have his number. Very well. I'm sorry for interrupting. Go ahead.
No, that's quite all right, Mr. Chair. Are you able to see my screen? Are we all good?
Yes, indeed.
Great.
So once again, as the chair noted, this is a report that we released last year, in February of last year, looking at safety in state correctional facilities, which we were asked to do by the Legislative Audit Commission. I'm going to run through five key things in this presentation, key concerns that we have. The first has to do with the weaknesses that the Department of Corrections had in terms of gathering information about safety and violence in prisons, concerns about staffing shortages, which we've already talked about a little bit, some concerns that we had about workplace culture within the prisons. We believe that there needs to be some better outside oversight, and we have a recommendation for the legislature about that, and some concerns about the infrastructure in the prisons. So that's where I'm headed. First, let me do just the quickest of overviews of Minnesota's prison system. As most of you are probably aware, there are 11 facilities, and they range from the minimum facilities, the boot camps at Togo and Willow River, up to the state's one maximum security facility at Oak Park Heights. And there are two facilities for special populations, the women's prison at Shakopee and the prison for juveniles at Red Wing. In 2020, and as the commissioner went through these numbers, so I won't go spend a lot of time on this slide, but there were 9,200 prisoners. About 3 out of 4 of those prisoners had been convicted of violent crimes of one sort or another. About 3,700 of Department of Corrections staff worked in the state's prisons, and the majority of those were corrections officers or other security staff. But there are also many other people who work in the prisons, including people who do food service, teachers, people who do behavioral health therapy and chemical dependency therapy, people who work in the industry areas where prisoners are employed, maintenance workers. So a lot of different people work in the prison serving this population and taking care of the facilities. So let me move to the first issue that I wanted to talk about, which is simply that it was difficult for us to answer the main question that we were asked. We were asked to determine how safe the state's prisons are. And that was difficult to do because, frankly, the department does not have the data that one would need to really measure safety very well. The department itself doesn't have any sort of formal measurement of safety. And the data that it does have often is incomplete and doesn't have the information that one might need. A good example is that you can get a count of the number of incidents that have occurred, say, of fights or assaults, but that is not tied to their severity. So we have no way of knowing if an assault that appears in the data meant that somebody got a couple of bruises or meant that somebody was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. So those are, of course, very different things when you're thinking about how safe prisons are. We had a concern about the department's biennial reports, which list the number of assaults that occur between prisoners, but omit fights, which those are two different categories of essentially the same sort of thing. Both of them involve prisoners that are interacting with each other and in a violent way in which someone can be injured, but only one is being reported and one is not. And lastly, I want to note that both prisoners and staff told us in our interviews and in our surveys that some violence is not observed by department staff, and so it's not reported and is not part of the counts that either are reported to the public or that we had access to in the work that we did. Nonetheless, even though we had some concerns about the data, we did see some broad trends that we felt that we could talk about. And that's partially because when we looked at a bunch of different incomplete sources of data, they all kind of pointed in the same direction, which gave us some confidence that what we were looking at was actually correct. So broadly speaking, violence between prisoners in the 4 years prior to our the release of our report decreased slightly each year. And that's certainly not to say that there were not some very serious incidents that happened in any of these years or in the last year. But generally, the trend was, you know, gradually declining over that period of time. With regard to violence against staff, and I will first note that there is far less violence against staff than violence between prisoners. Violence between prisoners is by far much more common. But in terms of violence against staff, what we saw was a spike that occurred in 2018, where we had far more incidents of violence against staff than we had had in the years previously or in the year following. And we do not, unfortunately, have a very good explanation for why that occurred. We noticed it. We saw it in a number of different forms of the data, but we don't have a good explanation for it. Most of the explanations that are out there that have to do with why violence occurs in prison would apply just as much to violence between prisoners as it would to violence that takes place against staff. And so when we have one trend that is gradually declining, another trend where we have a sudden spike, and yet the explanations you would tend to think would be the same, It is a bit of a puzzle for us. So we did see that, but as I said, the trend did decline after 2018. With regard to staffing shortages, and we've already talked about this a little bit, there have been some acute staffing shortages, and this was particularly the case in fiscal year 2019 at a number of the state's facilities. Stillwater, Faribault, and Oak Park Heights in particular, although other prisons also experienced some shortages. At the end of fiscal year 2019, Stillwater at that point was 40 staff below its allocation of 314 positions. So that's more than a 10% decrease from the number of staff. And I'm sorry, those are corrections officer staff that they were supposed to have at that time. However, it was difficult for us to be able to draw any kind of correlation between the number of staff working and the extent to which there was violence. And that's because the department did not track how many people were working at the facility during any given shift. We can see how many total individuals were employed, but that varies, of course, from shift to shift and from day to day in terms of how many people are actually working at the facility. Some days there, you know, the staffing is full, and some days that you have a lot of people out. And not being able to track that and compare that to when violence occurred meant that we could not draw a direct correlation. Nonetheless, we heard from both prisoners and staff when we surveyed them, when we talked to them, that they all felt that staffing shortages do affect safety. When you don't have as many staff working in the facility, it makes it harder to monitor prisoners to see what's happening. Staff are more vulnerable. They're working alone or in small numbers with large numbers of prisoners about them. When you have staffing shortages, prisoners are more frequently confined to their cells, and that can lead to increased tensions, and then also violence can break out as a result of that. And you have these facilities constantly running at a minimum. They're running with the bare minimum number of staff that they can get by with. And that means that there's no slack for sudden crises that come up, for unplanned events. And these unplanned events actually occur all the time. So each prison has an emergency response team, and we found that those teams were activated 1 to 3 times a day, depending upon the prison, at the prisons in the department's jurisdiction. And now those are not all fights. I mean, that could be for a medical emergency or, you know, a water main break or any sort of thing. But all the same, it means that staff have to go and take care of a crisis, and that means that they have to be pulled away from whatever they're doing. And that slack isn't there when you're running at the bare minimum of people able to run the facility. Staffing shortages also affect prisoner activities. As I pointed out, they're more often confined to their cells. When you don't have enough staff on site, it means you aren't able to provide prisoners with recreation time, or they aren't able to go to their education classes, or they aren't able to get to their chemical dependency therapy or their behavioral health therapy. They aren't able to go to their prison jobs. So all of these are activities that take prisoners outside of their cells. And the research is very strong that when you have more of those activities being provided to prisoners, that you do have a connection with less violence that occurs in prison. And it also has a connection with recidivism, that prisoners that have the ability to take part in a lot of different activities when they are in prison that take them out of their cells, they're less likely to commit additional crimes after they're released to the community. Staff and prisoners also, when we talked to them, agreed that providing those types of activities would make the facilities safer. Again, we were unable to draw direct correlations because the Department of Corrections does not track how often it cancels these types of activities. We weren't able to see, okay, on these days when these activities were canceled, more types of violence occurred. We weren't able to draw that connection. But we do feel that it's an important issue for prisoner safety. Another issue related to, I should say both prisoner and staff safety. Another issue related to safety is the use of overtime. As Representative O'Neill pointed out, officer overtime has risen dramatically between 2013 and 2019. Overtime for correctional officers nearly quadrupled. And many of those officers that were working overtime were required to work overtime by the Department of Corrections. That is that an officer would work a full 8-hour shift, and then they would be told at the end of that shift, you are required to stay here and work another 8-hour shift because we don't have somebody to take your place. The staff that we talked to overwhelmingly agreed that that large amount of overtime affects job performance. It makes, when officers are tired, they are less alert, they are more stressed, they are sometimes even more irritable, and all of those things can lead to lower safety within the facilities. We have some recommendations for the Department of Corrections. We encourage the department to continue its efforts to improve hiring and retention. I'm pleased to hear the commissioner say that that picture has improved over the last year. We suggested that the department increase its minimum staffing level for shifts so that it is better able to deal with those unplanned events that actually occur all the time and we think probably could be planned for a little bit. And the department needs to begin tracking the extent of staffing shortages, tracking the extent of the use of forced overtime and of cancellation of prisoner activities so that we can come up with a better understanding of the extent to which there's a relationship between these occurrences and violent incidents that occur in the prisons. I'm going to move on to another topic. I wanted to talk about workplace culture, and this was a concern that we found that was very troubling to us. We surveyed staff in the state's facilities, and we asked them, is bullying and harassment a problem at your prison? And 1 in 3 staff told us that it was. And the numbers were even higher for female and African-American staff. 40% of both of those groups told us that bullying and harassment was a problem at the prison where they worked. And this, we heard these responses across all prisons and across all job categories, higher in some, lower than others. But even at the facility that had the lowest numbers for this, it was still 1 in 5 staff saying that bullying and harassment was a problem. At Oak Park Heights, the numbers were actually a majority of staff. So it was a concerning thing for us to see. And we also heard in personal contacts, some people contacted us directly. Some of this was in interviews where we went to the prisons and talked with staff. We heard some stories of retaliation where staff told us that, you know, they were punished by their colleagues or sometimes by their supervisors for raising issues or for speaking out. A separate concern related to kind of the culture of how things happen at DOC's prisons has to do with the way decisions are made. We found that oftentimes administrators were relying on fairly subjective and informal impressions to make decisions about safety issues. Often a singular high-profile event would lead to a change in policy, but you might have something that kind of is a low-level thing that happens over a long period of time, and that wouldn't lead to a change, even though you would think that it would be something that would be noticed and addressed. We would ask administrators, have you made decisions that have improved safety? And almost always they were able to point to several decisions that they felt had made big differences. But then we would ask them how they evaluated whether or not those changes had made a difference. And often we came back to these more subjective, informal impressions. Well, I walk around and I talk to people and I hear from folks, and not a more careful kind of data-driven approach to evaluating whether or not safety had actually improved. Now, part of this was due to the department's data weaknesses, certainly, that administrators weren't being given the information that they needed to do that kind of decision making. But at the same time, we didn't see as much of a hunger for making decisions that way that perhaps we would have liked to see. So we have 2 recommendations for the Department of Corrections based upon workplace culture issues. Certainly that the department needed to take stronger action to address bullying and harassment among staff. And we encourage the department to move toward more systematic, more data-driven decision-making as a part of a regular course of doing business. I'm going to move on to the 4th element of the presentation now, and that has to do with oversight of the state's prisons. And frankly, there isn't a whole lot of systematic oversight of how safety occurs within the prisons that comes from outside of the prison. Mostly decisions are made inside each individual prison, and they kind of have to satisfy the folks there. There's not a whole lot of outside looking at it. This is very unlike, for example, county jails, which are required to be inspected and licensed on a regular basis, and not just security, but security is one of the things that are examined as part of that licensing process. Those licensing requirements have not been applied to DOC prisons. There have been a process that the Department of Corrections has administratively done, so it's kind of voluntary. It's not required by statute. And this is a peer review. They're called security audits, where staff from other prisons all come together for several days of an intense visit of a prison to examine the security procedures. And we thought that this was generally a good thing. We thought that they produced good recommendations, but we had two concerns about them. First of all, they're very infrequent. The last one prior to our report had been done at St. Cloud in 2011, so nearly 10 years or 9 years, and the recommendations from those security audits were not, they didn't have any teeth. They weren't binding. There was no requirement that those recommendations be addressed. And we saw in some instances where we were able to look at two security audits of the same facility that sometimes the second security audit would come back and refer to some of the things that had been raised the first time around that had never been addressed. So we have a recommendation here for the legislature, and we recommend that the legislature require some form of external assessment of prison safety using some sort of defined standards and happening on some kind of regular basis. There are two options that we've suggested for this. One might be to bring the state's prisons into kind of the licensure umbrella and have them go through this formal licensure process. That might require some changes to licensing standards because prisons are not quite the same as county jails, and they're very much not the same as county jails. The other possibility might be for the legislature to mandate the security audit process, to require it to happen on a regular basis, and to require that there be some sort of formal follow-up to the recommendations made from those security audits. Lastly, I want to talk about infrastructure, and I want to particularly talk about the infrastructure at St. Cloud and Stillwater. The living units at these facilities are over 100 years old, and frankly, nobody builds prisons like this anymore. And there's a reason that they don't build prisons this way anymore. It's because living units that are designed in this way create safety challenges that affect both prisoners and staff. This picture on the slide here is taken from the viewpoint of the officers station at one of the living units at Stillwater. And as you can see, it's going to be very difficult for officers at that station to be able to keep track of what's going on in those cells far out to the side or up several stories up into the air. Now, they do have cameras that allow them to monitor from a bunch of different angles, but that's a lot of cameras to cover a lot of different locations, and it's a challenging way to try and take care of things. The other thing to note is that those walkways in front of those prison, in front of those cells, those are pretty narrow walkways. And if you have a fight that occurs in a cell that spills out into the walkway, suddenly you have people that are struggling with each other 35 feet in the air above a concrete floor. And that's a danger both to the prisoners involved to the fight and to the staff that are racing up there to try and disentangle those prisoners and keep everyone as safe as possible. So we really think it is time for a conversation about what the long-term future is for these facilities. And we recommended that the Department of Corrections put together and present a long-term plan to the legislature for the rehabilitation or replacement of St. Cloud's and Stillwater's living units. And we recognize that that is a big ask. It's going to be a lot of money and it's going to be a lot of disruption. But we think that the time has come to start that conversation about what the future should be of the infrastructure of these facilities, because they're not going to get any younger. With that, lastly, I wanted to circle back to something I've talked about throughout the presentation, and that is we have a lot of concerns about the department's data collection. And we really think that what needs to happen is that the department needs to not just begin collecting a bunch more data, because that's time consuming and it's difficult, and they were already short staffed at the time we were doing our work. But rather they should transform their data collection processes, come up with new ways of gathering information so that they're gathering information about violent events, about staffing, about overtime, about prisoner participation activities, about discipline, and they're gathering it in a kind of an automated way, so it just becomes a natural part of the ongoing process. And at the end of the day, they have the data that they need to be able to make good long-term decisions that will improve security both for the residents at these facilities and for the staff that work there. And with that, Mr. Chair, I am done with my presentation, and I tried to move through it quickly enough so that there might be time for a question or two. I don't know if I did it. Nope, I'm not sure I did.
No, I think you did really well, actually. Thank you, Ms. Kirchner. Let me just say very quickly that my understanding is that, and really, truly, thank you. Thank you, because I had, you know, forgotten some of these recommendations and what a big impact they had on me when I first heard them. So I do hope that we can move on some of the at least some of the recommendations this year, either, executive authority within the department and or with legislation. It is my understanding that the department is bringing forward a number of bills. I haven't seen them yet, but I've had some soft conversations with the department about their bills, and that apparently a number of these recommendations are going to be embedded in those requests. So thank you for the work. The office, I always hold it in high esteem. It provides us with the necessary third perspective, if you will, on public policy that helps often guide good legislation. We do have two, so let me just call on them quickly, and I'll commit to getting at least these two in. I think, Representative Johnson, your hand is also up on this one, unless it was from prior, but I'll call on you first, and then Representative O'Neill.
Chair Mariani, Mr. Kirchner, I want to thank you for the presentation. That was interesting reading that whole report last year, and I'm glad we finally really get a chance to talk about it. Wish there's time for more questions. One issue that I'm concerned about, other than the bullying by staff that needs to be taken care of, is the overall inspections of the prisons. I know our county jails, I've worked in them myself. They're inspected yearly, I believe it's yearly, it might be biannually. Who would you suggest that we start inspecting our prisons, getting that information out beforehand before there's real problems? Do you know who inspects them in other states?
And Representative Johnson, just to be clear, you're talking about prisons, not the jails, is that right?
I am talking about the prison. None of our prisons are inspected whatsoever, while our county jails have to meet some strict standards, and there's no standards for our state facilities.
Okay, got it. Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. There's a couple of different directions I think that you could go in. I will first talk about a direction I will not suggest, actually, which is going through the accreditation process with the, and I've forgotten the name of the organization, but there's a national organization that accredits prisons. The department started that having its prisons accredited a few years ago, and actually decided to discontinue that during 2019 while we were working on our report. And frankly, we read through the accreditation reports and reviews that were provided by that accreditation body, and we weren't impressed, honestly. So we did not feel that we felt that that was a reasonable decision by the department to say that, there's not a whole lot of extra value added by that accreditation process. So the two approaches that we suggest that could be done, one would be some form of licensure, and that could be the department itself working along the same model that the Department of Human Services, for example, does, where they have a licensing division that actually licenses facilities that are also run by the Department of Human Services, and there is, kind of a wall between the two. That might be one approach, is to have the licensing division do that with regard to prisons. The other possibility, as I suggested at the end of the presentation, would be to use the already existing process of security audits, which the department does, but say it's not good enough to do it once every 9 or 10 years. You know, you need to do it every, you know, whatever it would be, every 2 years, and you, and put it in law that they need to do that, and put in law something about how they would do some sort of formal process of responding to the recommendations made as part of those security audits. We think either of those would be reasonable approaches, and it may also be the case that the department has some ideas for how they would like to pursue it. But we do think that it would be good to have a regular external check on the safety practices at these facilities.
Yeah, excellent question. Representative O'Neill, we're at time, but let's get your question in and keep going.
I'll be very brief. I just wanted to hear from the commissioner. This report came out in February, and wanting to know what action he's taken to make some cultural changes. That's something he and I've talked about for quite some time, specifically related to the sexual offenses, the bullying, and the intimidation. So if you could let us know what has been done differently since, well, we've been talking about this for 3 years, but this report came out in February of 2020.
Yeah, super quick, Commissioner. We will come back to this issue. I know that there are bills that the department, as I mentioned earlier, are fashioning that will touch on at least some of these, hopefully all of them, but Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, yes, I would just say that the biggest thing that we've done is we've put together this Office of Professional Accountability inside the agency, and that has really been focused extensively on trying to address these cultural issues. We investigate the incidents, but we then go back and say, what is the broad policy issue? That ultimately results or policy or supervision or whatever management issue that may come up that we need to change in order to prevent and manage that and minimize the risk of that ever happening again. And I would be happy at a later time to come in and talk about some of the things more specifically that we've put in place around that.
We will certainly have that conversation when those department bills come up. And Representative O'Neill, I'll look to you to help lead that that inquiry at that time. Members, with that, we are out of time. So we're going to adjourn in a few seconds. I just want to remind everyone that we are scheduled to convene on Thursday of this week, where we will be looking at a number of issues related to human rights and policing. So today we looked at human rights and the corrections community. This is a look at in policing. We'll be talking about some of the legislative responses to the killing of George Floyd last year, as well as hear a presentation from the Pulse Board in regards to their reform efforts. Should be a really good conversation. So, members, thank you for today's participation. And I look forward to, let me just end by acknowledging an important week this week, Dr. King's commemorative day. Yesterday is always a big week for Americans. And, of course, every 4 years, you know, a presidential inauguration. Hopefully you all have a chance to participate in that virtually tomorrow. So, members, until Thursday, this committee stands adjourned.